but if we need to...
Well, if something comes up, then you...
Bit, yeah.
Yeah, because one of the questions, and I think it is useful to talk about, kind of just the question of which projects you think are your most sort of significant or whatever, mm-hmm. how you define what that means. But
okay.
We can... I'm sure the material can be procured if they're not familiar already with the project. So do you want to just launch in? So another thing I should say is that, you know, we, in all the interviews so far and going forward, we feel like our role is really just as a kind of maybe...
chaperone.
an occasional provocateur.
Yes, exactly.
I like chaperone better.
Mm-hmm. It's been hard to restrain myself, I have to say, because I want to ask all kinds of questions too. But the point is really that you're interviewing them and we're acting as exactly just a kind of...
Like,
not even interlocutor. Yes.
Cool. What we...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sugar. Never mind.
Do we have to agree on the answers before?
Yeah.
So should Derek and I sit near each other?
We could make it into kind of like a game show.
Well, it's like the Newlywood Games. They're all half, most of them are kind of pairs, you know. It's like,
should actually answer separately and we'll compare.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Well, Eric said your most significant role is this.
That's why I think,
and then, yeah, what scores well if you answer the same thing? Or well, I mean, just to let you guys know, we thought we would mainly stick to the questions, but then we have some follow-ups where we, you know, kind of invented our own questions for you guys.
Because we didn't review the questions.
Oh, you did.
Oh, you just asked them last
week. But yeah, you've already seen them, I guess. So the first, start with the first one, which is about a question about who are your peers and who do you consider... to be part of this generation.
Should we change that? Oh, good idea.
I wish you can kick me under the table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can hear all the talking.
I can't.
No.
Who are our peers? Okay. Do you want to talk about that?
I think a lot of people who are on the interview list, I would consider our peers. And there are people who we feel like we have been kind of growing up with in terms of we starting our practices at the same time, starting teaching at the same time. And so those people would include Michael Meredith and Hilary Sample.
Eric and Mimi,
who graduated right ahead of me, or... Mimi graduated a year after, and Eric a year before.
At Cornell?
No, at the GSD. And, no, and then I think there are peers that we've met later in life. So, like, Hilary, Michael, Eric, Mimi, you know, we've known them over a decade. And then people like Marcelo Spina, we've met in the last 4 years. Who else are our peers? Eric?
Well, and isn't the second part of that, do you think of yourself as part of a generation? So did you say that's your generation?
Yeah, I think that's our generation.
Yeah, I think we're... I mean, the people we talk to all the time, include Michael Hansi and TJ at Studio Luz. You know, they're people that we email and say, do you have a drawing of this, and this, or do you have a contract for this, or that? We're constantly sharing, like, in a way, kind of practice stuff, you know, like client contracts.
Yeah.
You know, Michael's like, do you have how do you do a master plan contract? So it's not like we're sending, it's not like we're sending them sketches or ideas. We're sending them requests for practical stuff. Mm-hmm. Michael always sends me images of the stuff he's working on. I think that would be a nice thing. You know, he likes feedback. He's like constantly sending me, you know, here's a sketch, here's an animation. And, you know, I think that's great. We don't send out sketches very often.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like Eric and Mimi emailed last week asking for, do you guys have a rhino model of the Guggenheim? So they must be doing something with the Guggenheim, you know? Uh-huh. And, you know, of course, we pack it up and send it along. And I think that what's nice about who we consider our generation is I think everyone is sincerely interested in helping each other navigate the realities of practice or academics or a combination of both. And I think that's what links are, what we consider our peers, is they're all teaching and trying to practice simultaneously.
That's interesting.
No, I was thinking, like, would I ever email Michael and ask him for, like, a citation, like, a academic reference? Like, do you have a section of the La Brusta Library? You know, it wouldn't occur to me. You know, I think, like, I mean, everyone's teaching, but I think where everyone needs help, I think, is in practice. You know, because we're all kind of equally clueless to some extent. We're all kind of equally disadvantaged, and we're trying to pool our whatever resources we have, you know, to try to move forward. I think, you know, so far we haven't been in a position where we're competing with Michael for a commission. You know, maybe that would change. You know, we'd be a lot less friendly, maybe.
Well, right, I wonder, do you think that this generation is more likely to share in that way? And if so, do you think it's because of things about our kind of culture and education and generation, or is it the point of our professions at which we're at? Meaning, like, the generation that's now older, they have collaborated when they were young and now they're competitors?
I think it's both. I mean, I think there is something different about authorship today, you know. And the dumbest example is Wikipedia and open source information, you know. I think I was talking to Dennis Sheldon, who's the head, chief technical officer at Gary Technologies. He says 10 years ago, it would be unfathomable to send a CAD file to a contractor. You know, the liability involved with that would be too much. You know, and if you send it to somebody, you'd have a whole bunch of legal, you know, notation on the drawing to say any errors in here or, you know. So the idea of submitting CAD files now as part of our day-to-day process of fabrication is so normal now. The other dumb example is like MySpace, right? Like, not that we're on MySpace, but what I know about MySpace is that kids, students, they put everything on there. They have a different attitude about privacy, and it produced a different kind of openness, a different kind of transparency of information, which I think is a generational thing. I think people, you know, are more willing to share. They have less a kind of a sense of authorship or a kind of a sense of controlling information. There's more fluidity in that sense.
I also think we all start and built our practices in a time when there was a kind of economic boom. And so there were lots of projects for lots of people. And the way I think most of us started our practices were with small projects that became slightly bigger projects, et cetera, as opposed to all of us simultaneously being shortlisted on a 5-person shortlist for one competition, you know? And so we've been able to, based on our various connections and serendipity, et cetera, been able to, you know, build some things in the world, and they're not necessarily the things that we had all planned to build, but somehow through our collective knowledge, I think we feel equipped to take on more projects and more work because we know that everyone will have advice on and recommendations and, you know.
Speaking of generation, it also seems like from your description that although there is a camaraderie and kind of sharing of information and, you know, support of each other, there also seem to be a kind of maybe intentional and maybe it's good, a lack of or wanting not there to be something more formal that people form, like, a, you know, let's say 20 years ago you might have kind of formed a kind of group and made a statement or manifesto or whatever, but it seems like maybe intentionally that's also not present, and I wonder if you guys have any thoughts about that, whether it's unnecessary in these things.
Yeah, I think maybe we're all like our generation, so far we've only named Eric, Mimi, Michael, Hillary, and maybe they would be offended if I even said this, but I think we're all like, you know, we're the babies that grew up in post-structuralism, post-postmodernism, and so I think the big manifesto is something that we see kind of nostalgically. It's stuff that
the big project.
Yeah, the big project is you know, something that we find interesting, but part of the 60s, 70s
That's more history. No, I don't think we're sort of rallying around a sort of agenda. I mean, that may change, but so far there isn't a singular agenda that is confronting this generation. I think, you know, going forward, the economic crisis might produce a different kind of economy, a different kind of necessity, or a different kind of.
But I do think that over the last 10 years there have been certain agendas in architecture, whether that's computational or the paperless studio or these kinds of things. But I feel like our group, if we are a group, or our peers, are interested in multiple agendas simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So they haven't been able to say we are all about this one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, along those lines, do you think... given your description of your peers and your generation, are there some kind of unique characteristics or quality of your own interests and work that would distinguish you from some of the other firms on this list? Or do you think that you share the interests?
Yes.
I don't know. Sorry.
No. Michael was saying at some point, he's like, "I'll do anything. I'll do Victorian." He's like, he said it. It's true. And I think our generation is characterized by a kind of hunger to build and a hunger, a kind of post-ideological position. It's like I would never do a Victorian. I don't think I would, but the point is that he's saying we are beyond that. We're hungry enough that we'll do anything to learn, to build.
But also, given the task of doing something, let's say Victorian, you can make something interesting of it. I think how problematic the constraints might be, there's still something interesting you can do with that problem. And so we're not waiting for the pure, perfect project, whereas I think, let's say, what is that generation called?
The autonomy generation? No, I think there's a generation that would rather do paper architecture than sell out, And I think, we wouldn't say post-critical, but we would definitely say, we're the hungry generation. We'll do almost anything with the belief that we can do we can improve just about anything.
Back to Alexei's question. So you sort of grouped yourself, but do you think, again, is there something that distinguishes your practice, you think, from these other practices?
I think if you put up, everybody's young and everybody's still trying to sort of formulate where they are and what they believe. I think that's true. I think if you did put up an architect's project and a Moss project, and maybe one of our projects, I'd like to believe that there might be some confusion about what's what, who's who.
But I think there are distinct...
The formal differences so much as in the way you guys approach your work. What would you say, more substantively, because you've talked about, I think your question was perfect, because I was just about to butt in and ask, you've talked about it being... we graduated this time and this time and this time. Yes, that is part of what defines a generation as age, but that's not all. And what is it really? I would say on both sides, what defines it as a continuum, and then how do you differ from that in terms of substance, not in terms of simple temporal.
Yeah, I think the lack of a kind of singular agenda, which would make every project a kind of a piece of research, that would make every project an opportunity for some sort of innovation. It wouldn't be.
Sorry, to be clear, yes. That you're saying it distinguishes you, or that's just part of this.
That's
whole
part of this generation.
And then, how do you distinguish yourself from the rest of them?
I don't know. It's so easy to distinguish us from them, and I think that's what's
do want
interesting.
To? Or maybe not even.
I don't really mind. I don't know.
I think other people distinguish us from them. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a kind of perception that our work is different, or that some of our work is different. And that's the work that engages maybe the technology aspect of architecture first. As a kind of primary goal to the design research going on. And so, we were able to do some small interactive projects kind of early in our design career, and some of those have led to larger, more permanent projects. And I think we think of those as maybe an area that has distinguished us from other offices only because we had the opportunity to do them, not necessarily because we planned to do that as part of our architectural project. It has more to do with the kind of opportunities made present at institutions like MIT. And I think, like, I just wonder, had Hillary been teaching at MIT, would that have also happened? And I think maybe it might have. I'm not so sure. But I think that's...
It wasn't that you were predisposed to seek out technological integration. You know, the integration of technologies into architecture, that's not an idea that sort of pre-existed your time at MIT. So, I mean, it's not that you weren't sort of conscious or, an author in that process, but it's not that we set out to do this thing because we had this idea or this belief structure.
But I do think, like, because it is part of our everyday experience, and like technology is accessible and experimentation was going on, that you can ask certain questions like, what if I could, do X, Y, and Z? And I think I wouldn't have asked the question, what if I could, if I was in a different institution. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, you say, like, it's not that we were predisposed, but at the same time, if I look at my colleagues at MIT, save for maybe one, nobody on the architecture design faculty is engaged in those kinds of projects. Mm-hmm. So,
but I would say that you guys are engaged in very similar kinds of projects. I'd say Eric and Mimi have been interested in sensors and spaces that are variable, reconfigurable. I think there is an interest that is pervasive and that we don't have any claim over. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can claim that.
Maybe once we'll take it to, it's not like it just emerges from the institution.
Yes.
Because you happen to be somewhere. That,
right.
Yeah. It's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. Some interest, some draw,
I think also, like, back to my thing about, like, sometimes I see something like Eric and Mimi did, and I'm like, oh, that's so cool. I wish I had done that, or something that Michael does. And, I think that there are a series of projects that they may have done them first, but I think that the sort of interest in certain geometries or interest in certain situations might be a shared interest. That is not something that any one of us could make a strong claim for having invented. I think we're kind of past that. I don't think Marcel is going to say, I invented the kind of lock,
monocoque.
Or I invented the monocoque, or I invented
right.
the ruled surface. These are all techniques that have been available. That mm-hmm. are, like, this, back to this idea of open source, I think there is something that people pick it up, they modify it, they put it back in the world.
Mm-hmm. And there are things sometimes that are just, it's about time for that thing to emerge, And one of the funny things is I taught a workshop with David Small over the winter break, and we gave back-to-back lectures, and in his lecture he showed the Nobel Peace Prize project, which has a field of LEDs that, like, change, etc., and they're about the same height, and he said this, he told the story that they were, like, four months away from completion of that project, and then suddenly all these images of our project from Athens started to pop up. Mm-hmm. And they're like, crap. And then his came later, but, so ours was first, but in fact, we were probably developing them at the same time. And the thing is, like, the blue LEDs had just become very affordable. Mm-hmm. Microcontrollers had become very accessible. Mm-hmm. It was the time for that to happen, and many people were working on that simultaneously and in different contexts. So
Well, maybe that's a good transition to the next question, which is kind of about who your teachers and role models are. But I like what you're, like, maybe to consider your previous comments to be partly an answer to that. You might be suggesting that some of your teachers and role models are your peers, mm-hmm. that you've been able to learn through this, mm-hmm. You know, collaborating, sharing, open source model, mm-hmm. like the time being ripe for something to emerge. But so, I'm curious to know in general who you would consider your teachers and role models, but then also specifically if there's an older generation that mm-hmm. you've derived stuff from in addition to your current generation.
Yeah. I mean, an easy answer would be, you know, up is down. Nader has been incredibly supportive as a mentor. You know, we never worked for Nader, but he's always supported us. And that's simply because he's in Boston, we're in the same sort of community. He sends us his accountant, he sends us his attorney, he sends us his contacts, he sends us images of projects that he's done. So he's always been supportive.
I think also Nader is, in general, very supportive of the next generation. I think he's always been a very generous person in that way. I'd say, in addition to Office Da, KVA, I mean, I think Sheila Kennedy and Frano's work kind of paved the way for a precedent of an architectural practice which also engaged in materials and technology research at some scale. And, you know, the amazing thing about both Office Da and KVA is somehow in the conservative town of Boston, they were both able to create really unique practices around their interests and make those practices viable. And I think that is a huge encouragement as a young practice.
What about outside of architecture?
I think Saul Griffith, do you know Saul Griffith? Saul is amazing. He founded a company called, what is the company called? Squid Labs? No, Squid Labs. He won the MacArthur 2 years ago, and he is trained as a material scientist originally, and then he did a PhD at the Media Lab, and he would run like little workshops on kite surfing where people would build giant kites. He also invented a way of making eyeglasses for very, very, like, lenses at a very, very affordable cost, because he radically transformed the way in which one goes about molding, making, etc. And he was very entrepreneurial, and then as soon as he finished his PhD at the Media Lab, he went and started Squid Labs, which does just, like, a huge range of projects, and he's also involved in Make Magazine. So I think it was his... You can't put this on the recording, but I think it's his girlfriend that started Make Magazine, or somehow there's a strong relationship to Make Magazine. And so I think at that extreme about open source, do it yourself, sharing knowledge, I think he's been one of those people. I'd say John Maeda and his attitude towards design and life has also been kind of important.
Are you thinking of somebody in particular?
No. Really, I mean, part of my question came from the fact that I know Eric. Like, I've always been impressed by the fact that you've managed to, even when working insane hours at Dillerson Video, like, be one of the most well-read people I know. And so I figured this must have had
some impact.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think for Eric it would be Hal Foster. I mean, you always talk about Hal.
No, but that's like someone you read in grad school who impresses you because they have this incredible sort of command over what you think is the discourse. And so you idolize someone like Hal Foster, who's an art historian, but he seems to be sort of so facile with issues of culture at large, you know, someone like that. I was thinking, like, the funny thing about this generation is everybody grew up reading Deleuze and Jameson. You know, like, and I haven't read them since. But, you know, you ask everybody here, like, okay, that you know the thing about the, you know, cognitive mapping. You know, like, there are certain things that, I don't know if students read that today, but they definitely did.
Oh, I gotta get more.
Okay. So I think we do share a kind of similar set of texts that we all read in grad school.
That's
awesome.
The Bonaventure Hotel.
I think that's what makes us a generation.
We all, you know, Jameson blew our minds when we were like in our early 20s, mm-hmm. and we haven't been the same.
You're barely early 20s now.
So we grew up with Deleuze and Jameson. Mm-hmm. I would say for me those are the texts that we read in grad school that were so like intense. Mm-hmm. Have we read them since? Do we quote them daily? Not really. You know, I think you know.
So we read them in like every class. So we read the text like 8 times before graduating.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. You know, I worked at Deleuze Gifidio, and you know, working somewhere, you do invest in that place, and you do pick up a lot of habits. You know, and right. I think one of the intense work environment at Deleuze Gifidio. Maybe we all have that in us, that kind of intensity. But I think you know, one thing I've taken and applied in our own office is this kind of this intensity of when we do a project that it must be both smart and strong and good in terms of design and form, but also in terms of like, does it have a sort of critical dimension? Could it be some sort of commentary? Could it sort of poke at a certain issue? Mm-hmm. And they do have a similar interest in technology. You know, after we did White Noise, White Light, I looked back at some of the early Lincoln Center renderings and I found that in fact there were illuminated fiber optics, you know, growing out of the ground in a Lincoln Center rendering, which I didn't know. And Liz probably thinks that we sort of ripped that off, but I think there was something in the air that you could have both a kind of a natural sort of tall grass and a kind of artificial tall grass, that they were both sort of coexisting. And I think that interest in synthetic and natural and the kind of questioning one category, you know, by another, might be something that we've sort of taken, or maybe that's something that's just shared. You know, that's just a shared interest or obsession. Mm-hmm.
So, just to move on, I guess, what has been your most significant and challenging project so far, and why? What scale? What made it so challenging?
Who wrote these questions? Is this a collective?
You didn't have a problem with them when you were asking them.
But we didn't ask them.
Oh, you just you freestyled?
Did we?
We
talked to most of the topic.
You guys aren't, like, getting back at them.
Yeah. Should we get back at you guys?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I mean, that's a tough question. I'm not sure I like it, because it puts so much pressure on one thing. And I think
our goal has always been to not
put just challenge.
Or then maybe to rephrase it, doesn't have to be a project, but what part of your process or what part of realizing a project that you find most challenging, maybe is a better way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll go there. White Noise, White Light was a project that Majin did, you know, for the 2004 Olympics. It was something that she started doing. I'll just tell the story. I mean, you were teaching, I was at Deleuze Gifidio, she had this idea, she had this competition. No idea how it would be realized. You know, it's like, wouldn't it be great if these things sort of lit up and reacted to you? I mean, we're sure it can be done. We just don't know how. And so the competition.
Not quite true,
okay. Well, the competition was submitted.
Only you could suggest your naivete, not Eric. Right?
Yeah. No, the competition was suggested. It was won, and then there was this idea like, how do we realize this?
Right.
And the logistics were intense, you know, shipping, you know, wood deck from Brazil to Miami.
Yeah, I mean, prior to that project, like...
Wait, to Miami, then to Athens, right?
No, then I went to Germany, and then it was trucked to Athens. So
there was some.
I think, like, prior to that project, we did this one interior wall that had, you know, sensors... IR sensors, a little microcontroller, and things that spun, you know, it was very, you know, rudimentary, but it was interactive. And it was that project that led someone to invite us to do the Athens competition. And when we submitted, we're like, well, it is going to use exactly the same set of technology, so it's definitely viable. But we didn't know exactly how much it would cost. We didn't know exactly how we're going to make everything waterproof. We didn't know exactly what the, you know, voltage was going to be, et cetera, et cetera. But we sent some compelling images, and then we got the project. And I think the most difficult thing about that project was the risk and responsibility. Mm. Not the design, not the logistics of actually working through all of that stuff. Like, we were able to do that with a lot of good advice and good consultants. But it was the holding the contract for a $100,000 project, which had a penalty clause that if you didn't deliver on time and if it didn't work, you were in trouble. And if you want to innovate and do something new, it is very, and you understand at that moment, that was the moment I realized why architects do exactly what has been done before. Mm-hmm. It is tried and true. And if you're going to take on the responsibility and liability to do something brand new with the same budget that someone's going to do something easier for, then it's really challenging, because you need to do the R&D, you need to test it, and then you need to produce it.
And then take responsibility for it.
All in the same time frame that someone could spec something, you know. So to really do customized projects, and I think this is true whether it's related to electronics or to digital fabrication, I think the whole role of doing customized projects that are 100% from scratch, new, is the most challenging part. And still doing it for the right budget, the right time frame, and assuming the same responsibility and liability.
Right.
Which you guys must have found to be true as well.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear that exact story, because I think we are at a kind of similar place right now for this semi-permanent public artwork we're installing in Seoul. And the organization that's hosting the competition one is something really new and innovative, but the bureaucracy is not ready to support anything that's actually new and innovative. So we have to somehow figure out our own way to go between the two.
Yeah, I mean, what we tell clients sometimes, and we get in trouble, we say, you could spec a product, but it's going to look like Christmas lights, and we can do something for the same budget that's going to look like jewelry, and it's going to behave better, it's going to be customized to your specific needs. And we can do the R&D, we can develop, and we can install it
for the same
budget. And we did this for Low Rise Hi-Fi, which is a project in D.C. Mm-hmm. You know, we looked at some off-the-shelf products, and they looked like Christmas lights. They were terrible. We really wanted something that you could sort of see. We wanted something two-sided, so you had sort of transparency. Mm-hmm. And then we pitched it to the owner, and he believed us. And then we said, okay, now we have to figure it out. So there's a risk in that as well. But I think it's true. I think you could do innovative stuff for the same budget and get something more specific to what you want.
Yeah, but the people that are making... But the thing is, the people that are making those products, like, let's say, Color Kinetics, before it was absorbed by Philips, right? They are very clear. They only have this many products. If you want customization, you need, like, a huge order and a long lead time. Mm-hmm. But each of the thing they make, it's a product, so they can actually make money over a longer time, because the first time they use it, maybe they're losing money. Or, you know, the first part of the R&D, they're losing money. But because as designers, we believe in doing completely one-off projects that are unique and custom to whatever conditions surround that project, we can't then turn it into a product and then sell it. So, like, a lot of people have asked us, why don't you?
Right.
And our electronics engineer for Low Res Hi-Fi does have a patent on that double-sided LED pixel. And in the end, we're like, okay, you take the patent. Like, he's the engineer. He resolved all the tedious aspects of the circuitry, et cetera. And, you know, I don't want to be in the position of a business of selling a product. I want to be a designer that's taking on new challenges all the time. But I think from the risk financial point of view, you understand why those companies who spend a lot of money on the R&D, you know, charge so much for their product and are unwilling to do much adaptation or...
No, but just to be clear, so when you say you can do that for the same price, you're saying we can give you this custom product for the same price as the off-the-shelf one. That's because basically there's all these people hours that you basically aren't charging for, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
that's
because
you're doing the R&D for it.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're doing all the like, you know, when we can't afford to send out the boards to be done, we solder them ourselves. I mean, it's just, that's the way we can get these things out in the world, and hopefully if these things are out in the world, there'll be more demand because there'll be more interest, and then more people will be doing it, and I think all that's good.
Yeah. In general, how do you guys test for robustness if it's something that you're doing for the first time and it has to be there for, like, how many years or whatever?
You know, when we were doing our thermal testing, we would just put it in the oven and take it out of the oven, put it in the oven, then put it in the freezer, and then take it out of the freezer, and then put it in the oven. I mean, it sounds so rudimentary, but this is what our electronics engineer advised us, who has this very fancy machine that actually allows you to do the kind of huge thermal range. And we borrowed it for a couple afternoons and did some preliminary testing, and he's like, you know, guys, it's the same thing as putting it in your toaster oven, putting it in your freezer, and putting it in your toaster oven. And I think the other answer to that question is the way we test robustness is it goes in, we keep our fingers crossed, and we evaluate, and so far, so good. But there's only so much you can test, right? And so when a client asks for a 10-year warranty on something, you're like, wow. Yeah. Because that's where, like, architecture and electronics don't interface, right? Uh-huh. So, like, you know, your color kinetics only warranties 1 year, or your iPod is only warranted 1 year. But this window sash is probably warranted, if it's a new product, for 10, 15 years. And so you are in this position of...
No, when we did Larissa High Five, the owner's like, well, how's it going to react to, like, Washington, D.C.? It's hot, it's cold, it's hot, it's cold. It's rainy, whatever. And he said, well, he's like, well, why isn't it done yet? And I'm like, well, take your iPod and put it outside for a few days and see how long it lasts. And, like, you're asking something to behave like an iPod, yet you're asking it to have longevity like a piece of architecture. And that's the thing. I mean, these things are obviously on different sort of time scales. And your computer's not going to last for 10 years. Like, any piece of software is going to be obsolete, you know, so much faster.
Yeah, even if it's not out in the weather.
Yeah.
And you guys know this.
But the funny thing is we are in a position where, like, now that we're doing architectural projects of larger scale, we're learning that it takes just the same amount of time to develop a kind of electronic public space project that is all of like 2,000 square feet as it does to do a 10,000 square foot building from start to finish. And so, like, why would you do the small, you know, art project that is going to lose money versus the bigger architectural project that, you know, will hopefully at least break even? And I think our attitude has been it's okay to actually lose money on the R&D projects because they are research and they're putting things out in the world that we think are important to test in the public realm. And then that's okay.
But does it
work together because you're both in this kind of DIY camp, if you will. So I just thought it would be nice if you could talk a little bit about how you guys deal with the test day, because this is the kind of real overlap that you have.
Yeah.
How you guys deal with the R&D and the testing.
It's interesting. Right. It's interesting to hear your description because some of our, at least initial, experiments with electronics and responsive systems have been grant-funded or kind of self-funded, have not had a specific client. And that's allowed us an interesting freedom, although it's had its own limitations. And now that we're doing more projects at a slightly bigger scale with a slightly longer time frame and for clients who are, you know, kind of saying yes or no, it's
and have the clause, the clause too.
And contracts.
Yeah, the contract clause at the end.
It's very similar to what you're describing. And I don't know, part of what it makes me think, actually, and to hear, you know, one of the ways you just described your projects, is that I hope for our practice that we'll continue to have a way to do our R&D without clients. So you described a way to do R&D with clients and mm-hmm. lose money, but still do something cool and get it out in the world. But maybe there's another category, at least, that's been part of our development so far that's like, there's no client, or we get the grant to do it, and we mm-hmm. write the grant so that it's open-ended enough what our deliverable is. And
yeah.
We like that process, or we've liked it in the past, because it allows us to respond to the results of the test. Mm-hmm. Because we've had experiences like you described where we make the image, and then the person who wants that image says, why is it not like this image? And we say, well, we learned this thing that's like so much cooler and better. And they're not at all interested in that conversation. And so another thing that kind of rings true to hear your description is that conversation with the client mm-hmm. and how much time we're going to spend and how valuable we think mm-hmm. it is to say to a client, look, it's an iPod in a building at the same time. Or mm-hmm. we have a process of developing these things where the creative process and the testing and the prototype leads us to new realizations yeah. that actually make it better than if we just totally imagined it and then had to execute it no matter what.
Yeah, right? No, I think that's true. And we do the same thing still. We still apply for grants and we do like test projects. This is one of them. Where there is no client and we find some excuse, like an exhibition or an installation, to do it. And hopefully that research can be incorporated into another project in the future. Mm-hmm. But we find that the grants, or the largest grant we've ever gotten is $50,000, and we find that still that's not enough to do the R&D. Like, you need like a commitment from the client for significantly more than that. And I think one way we structured the design schedule is very different from architecture, where there's an R&D prototyping phase and the contract doesn't move on for the actual, you know, installation or whatever until the prototyping is done, and then you can do realistic budgeting. And I think cost is a big issue, because of course clients want to know how much it's going to cost, but you cannot put a number at what something's going to cost until you've done the R&D and the prototyping. And even after that, you could still be off by like 25-35%, right? So I think this is getting really technical and contractual, but I think that it's a good approach to keep getting the grants and doing smaller scale research and prototyping. But until the clients, like, in the world understand the value of something like that, mm-hmm. I think that they will always stay as art projects and be limited from being seen as an architectural project, you know?
Well, you know, so one other slightly different question would be about how some of your projects expand the realm of what architecture is. And I think that's certainly true in a lot of the projects that you've done, and maybe the ones you're calling research. That might be one kind of first answer to that. But I'm also thinking, you know, if I were DuPont or 3M, I would totally want to give you guys, like, double or like quadruple that $50,000 grant for you to work on something that might be relevant to my research and development as a big company. So I wonder if you've ever thought about stuff like that. I mean, could there be a role for some of your kinds of prototyping, research, materials, technologies in conjunction with a bigger industry, or, you know, like with Color Kinetics or those mm-hmm. kind of people? Like, and would you want to do that, or is that something that's just too far afield?
I think we've always been a little bit cautious about the interactive architecture and things like that, because we still believe that its fullest potential is through a integration with architecture. And I guess we don't want to become interaction designers. We want to figure out how this can become critical in space and place.
How it can augment a kind of material condition beyond just a kind of product that you would sort of overlay on top of an architecture. So it's not a supplement, but it's somehow integral to the space or integral to the environment in which it's inserted.
But I think the what you suggest about, like, if 3M came to us and said, or if we went to 3M and said, look, if you give us this amount of money, we can do some really interesting projects that might be of use to you. And I think that's very much the Media Lab model, like not committing to exactly a deliverable, but saying that we'll play with your stuff and do some really interesting things that might be of value to you as a company. I guess we've just never thought that was possible for us.
Well, we never wanted to do a product. We always wanted to do a kind of site-specific design.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, yesterday I met this guy, Bill Price, who teaches in Houston. He's an architect. He's developing Litracon, which is the kind of transparent concrete. And he was just telling me that, you know, he was doing this research with fiber optics and concrete. Simultaneously, someone in Europe was doing the same research. Simultaneously, DuPont launched a kind of research group to do the same thing. Huh. You know, so in a way, he said he was developing the stuff, but in the end, he didn't really want to own a patent, didn't want to sort of sue other people, didn't want to, like, you know, corner the market on translucent concrete. You know, he really wants to find applications where he can do it.
Yeah.
And I think we share the same thing. I mean, if DuPont wanted to give us money to, like, develop something that they could then market, I don't know. I'm not sure that's so interesting. If DuPont wanted to give us money for us to do a cool project that would be site-specific and authored, I think that would be different. But I think this realm of, like, going to a product design versus a kind of an intervention, I think not so much.
Going back to something you guys mentioned about, like, the interactivity in architecture, David and I sometimes, like, talk about this or have debates about it even, and I'm still wondering kind of for myself whether that's something that's just another layer in architecture, like, you know, when, like, sprinklers first came along, it's another layer, and then it gets specialized for somebody to take care of, whether it's going kind of that route, or is it something that could potentially, like, really fundamentally change how people perceive and use space, you know? Whether it gets really specialized or it becomes something much more fundamental and big. And
I don't really see it that way. Like, I think of it more like that these projects test sets of relationships and creating kind of relationships that exist within certain scripted, I think of it much more like the point of the interaction or the interactive architecture is not that it's technology or interactive or whatever, but it's studying sets of relationships and triggering relationships and then studying how time affects those things. And I think architecturally that is always present too, like whether the thing moves or you move, their architecture is about these kinds of sets of relationships and organizing those relationships and then finding opportunities in those relationships. So I think probably a lot of this technology will just become embedded in the materials and things like that, and I think that's like the, let's say, the Media Lab fantasy of how that would happen. For us, I hope that the research is higher than the actual technology and can establish certain things that might not have literal technological application. And I think there's some of our architectural projects that start to begin to do that. Like when we did Hover, like in fact that project, which is very much a technology project, led to a way of thinking about 20,000 square foot building in Chengdu that doesn't move and doesn't have photovoltaic panels, but the, you know, idea of how...
Technique.
Yeah, it's a technique of packing, but then biasing towards the sun, mm-hmm. That creates some variation between the section and then the plan.
That's a good read.
But isn't that what happened?
No, it is.
That's what happened in my mind.
It is. No, it's interesting. Like, I mean, if we talk about these things as research, and we're researching both technological, specific technologies and specific techniques, you know, so the technique of packing material, biasing the material towards a particular solar orientation, is true for Hover, is true for the Chengdu project. So the architecture takes on the same geometry as the Hover project, and that was based on trying to get photovoltaics to face the sun, and then in the building we're trying to produce a kind of passive solar geometry that's specific to an angle. So I think that was true, and that did sort of go through. I thought what you were saying was that that architecture has always been about effects, you know, whether they're electronic or light-based, you know, whether it's, you know, shadow or light or whatever, form produces effects. And I think some people might argue that you know, the Baroque is a kind of special effects machine, you know, and that you know, we have different devices today, but the same set of interests, you know, the production of special effects as architecture's mission. We just have different tools or capabilities. I thought Meijin was saying that the relationships between people are what's interesting, and that's something that we didn't set out to do, but we learned by observing our projects that people react to these things. Mm-hmm. And then we said, well, how can we produce that? You know, how does you know, a transparent double-sided LED pixel net in the middle of the sidewalk encourage people to interact with the thing and then maybe interact with each other?
But can I pick up, like, I think the effect thing is something I missed, and I think it is really important that for us the effect has to have a relationship to form. If the effect is totally embedded and invisible and absorbed in a drywall wall, and we can get the effect but not have to change the drywall, I think we would find that disappointing. Like, we do hope that the relationship between the effect and the form are integral. And I think that's part of the underlying kind of research component in addition to the technology.
Well, we were anxious about low-res Hi-Fi or white noise white light because it was a field of transparent fibers, you know, and it didn't have a form. You know, the patterns emerged as people worked through it, and the effects were sort of flickering and elusive. But in the end, there wasn't any sort of form there. And there was a bit of anxiety about that, I have to say. And so, you know, we started to do other projects, like, say, this one here, the Entesis project, where we're interested in servo motors controlling a plastic geometry, which through rotation and compression can produce a kind of expansion. And, mm-hmm. and we thought if we could control that volume with a degree of precision, we could produce a kind of, Meijin calls it a spatial valve, you know, so we can have a kind of a portal that might sort of open up, allow you to slip through, and then have it close up. So this was more about a kind of interaction between computer-controlled mechanism and a form, and then bodies interacting with that form. So the kind of ephemerality of white noise, white light that sort of left us somehow not quite satisfied. We're looking for ways to interact material with behavior in ways that might sort of require...
Capitalize on their formal properties as well, would say.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're not content with just effect, I guess. The kind of material, immaterial, the interaction between the two is what makes it interesting.
And but the I one think white noise, white light could not exist in any other way. Like, I think the form would have begun to compete with the effect there, and I also think, like,
I don't have any regrets about it.
But I would say, definitely as an architect, it really took a lot of restraint to make a field that had no formal qualities, no geometric complexity, no, you
it's
know.
It's not true. It's not an intro field. There's a bias to that field.
I know. It's very subtle. But it took a lot of restraint to do that because as architects, it actually gets denser the further away it is, and that actually makes the perspective look deeper, you know.
It looks like it goes
forever.
Yeah. It looks very deep in the perspectives, but it's actually
as deep as it is wide. Yeah. It's a square in plan. But
Well, I think that's evident in any of your interactive projects, but your other projects as well, that it's not technology for its own sake, and it's not effect for its own sake, but it's very kind of precise interventions to trigger something about relationships, I mean, most generally, but yeah, people and how they interact with their space or with each other. Are there precedent projects for you? Are there other projects in either art or architecture that hit on some of those same kind of trigger points, either electronic and responsive or just maybe architectural and spatial that are...
I think like Vito Acconci's walking project, following.
Yeah, we always show images of Vito sort of following somebody, and for me that project is brilliant because it sort of traces the kind of public realm just by a kind of very small, you know, essentially his performance, right? By following someone until they go into their house or into a car, he kind of produces a map of the public realm, which is so interesting. You know, it's such a low-res image. Right?
Yeah.
We love that kind of...
It demarcates public and private space, which I think is also interesting.
And so a lot of our projects have dealt with the public realm and somehow sort of mapping some qualities that can only happen in the public realm that wouldn't happen in an interior.
I'd also say like Solowitz wall drawings, that there's a simple set of rules, but depending on which context, like which wall you're drawing, those rules actually create a different final result. I think that's something that influences the way we think.
And you know, maybe it's not cool to say, but...
Be careful.
Yeah, no, I mean, Oliver Eliasson is someone that's done some pretty cool stuff with atmospherics, you know.
Yeah.
You know, through light and perception. You know, every time I see one of his projects, I'm impressed by the kind of the devices and the techniques, and they're never all the same. They're always different devices, whether it's fog or whether it's reflection or whether it's light or whatever. So, I mean, he's someone we think is pretty cool. But you know, he's not an architect. He's not working within the context of producing essentially, you know, buildings that have programs and have uses and so on. So we'd like to think that architecture could have that kind of impact, that kind of but we recognize that the space of the gallery sets a different frame of perception versus the space of the public realm, where there's this, you know, distraction, there's, you know, all kinds of things competing for your attention. So, you know, he has the luxury of working within a gallery, and I think, you know, we like the possibilities that are opened up in the public realm. You know, if you could produce similar kind of perceptual sort of plays within the public realm and play on that distraction, that would be kind of interesting, I think. I mean, I think that's what makes it architecture and not gallery art. So we disclose some of our heroes, extra-disciplinary heroes.
Along those lines, what are your resources, like kind of physical resources or... resources in terms of books and magazines and Wikipedia. You mentioned
what do we look at?
Yeah,
it's funny because Misha doesn't look at any blogs. She doesn't want to know what anyone else is doing. You know, she would rather sort of be original.
Thanks for disclosing that.
No, she's completely like blog adverse.
I'm anti-blog. And I don't want to know what anyone's saying about us either. So,
on the other hand, I surf and I look and I have, you know, Google tells me when someone's written something about us, and I read everything, and I look at everything. I late at night, I'm always like figuring out like what's on Dazeem, what's on Archinect, what's on Building Block. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, so and so did a cool project. So it's good to know, you know, and if you can rip them off, or they can rip you off. I mean, you should know who's out there.
I mean, you don't have to read. Sarah is all reading, right? So.
No, I think it's important to know what's going on out there. And I think I would say that there's a new readership out there. It's not just books. I haven't read a book in a long time. You know, now my attention span is really sort of compressed. You know, I read Log magazine because the articles are so short. No. And they're punchy. And they're
Eric, be careful what you disclose.
No, you know, like, who's going to read Grey Room? You know, that stuff is, you know, impossible. But I read every magazine that comes along. But no books.
No books.
What about
Twitter?
I mean,
I think we read very specifically, too. Like, when we're researching a certain thing, then we'll go to the library and check out every book on that topic. And it's not really reading, in my opinion. It's like, you know. Yeah, it's so opportunistic. It's like looking for something. It's mining, you know. So we'll still mine. We'll go to the library.
Visual mining or idea mining?
No, I think idea, visual, but also technique or,
sort of searching rather than
browsing. Yeah.
But I think there's always just enough research. I mean, it's not too much. It's probably too little, actually. But, you know, like, this project, it was like, okay, let's make this dynamic thing. And then we're like, what should we call it? Oh, maybe we'll call it Entesis. What is Entesis? Let's figure out what people have talked about Entesis. You know, the funny about Entesis is, like, nobody really knows. You know, it is an enigma within architecture.
Like,
why geometry felt like it produces a kind of imperfection to create a kind of optical sense. You know, it's like, it can't be explained in a purely functional or kind of classic or in any kind of pure way. So we're like, oh, this is a cool concept. Let's research it just enough, you know, to, in a lecture, be able to say a few sentences about it intelligently. But it's not a kind of art historian or architectural historian sort of exhaustive research, you know, master lecture, going back, you know, finding all that stuff. I think when there's a concept, we can gather just enough information in order to do it, in order to pull it off.
But also just enough that we can not feel constrained by the research,
right.
Because I think sometimes if you know what it's really for, it will be very hard to be opportunistic about that. So,
going back to the first question, do you think the generation we're talking about shares that kind of attitude, maybe?
As Eric or as me? Because we're opposite in this regard, right?
I think everybody's out there doing all kinds of reading, all kinds of browsing and searching, and I think it's not just books. I was thinking, like, when we were students, you know, I remember in third year I found my first issue of PA, and it was like this, it was like porn, you know, I was like, oh my god, you got a copy of PA, and we would, like, look through it, and it was so exciting to see, like, Wes Jones is doing this thing, you know. So, you know, the discovery of you know, print media within architecture school was a rare thing. You know, getting a hold of architecture magazine at the time was a rare thing. Now we're awash in public. We can't deal with
keep
the piling
up,
around us. There's so many.
And you have to pick which one. Like, you're like, okay, Detail and Metropolis and Wired. Okay, that's it. You know. So I try to limit the amount of publications that come in.
All of them.
Those, and then Architecture, Architect.
Architect comes for free.
Record or no?
Record? Grey Room?
I'm AIA, so I get the Record.
You do get Grey Room, even though you don't read it.
You know what, I stop my subscription, but I buy an occasional one when it's a topic that's interesting. I stopped my subscription to October because I just didn't have the time for that. But every once in a while I'll buy one when I see it, and there's something relevant in it.
What about publications in outside of the field or blogs or resources? I mean, for example, do you look at all the TED Talks? Do you read the New Yorker?
I'm on my iPhone and watch a few every day.
Yeah. I every once in a while I'll go and find one when I know that there's something that I need. But, you know, we are so attention deficient, and And we are so time deficient that there's really, you know, no time for...
You have no choice but to be opportunistic.
Yeah. We have, I don't know, our lives just get worse and worse. I mean, our 90-hour weeks have become 110, 120-hour weeks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're sleeping in shifts so that someone can be up all night with whoever else is up all night in the office. And it has become really unhealthy and unsustainable. But it's because we entered this path, and it's hard to get off that path of trying to be innovative.
How many hours do you guys teach?
I think officially it's like 12 to 15 hours a week. Maybe, Eric, you have a little bit more of a teaching load, so maybe 20 hours a week. We find ourselves at school probably more like 30 to 40 hours a week, and then we still try to get 40, 50 hours a week to the office, so...
The math doesn't add up.
Yeah, it doesn't. It really doesn't.
No, but I think teaching is something that we haven't really talked about. I think everyone in the group teaches, and it is, I think, a source of nourishment for everybody, a source of new ideas, a source of energy, even though it's exhausting. You know, we all sort of put in so much time teaching, but we also get a lot out. I think it's true for everybody. Yeah. You know, and that's the deal we've made. I don't think anybody in this group would choose not to teach. You know, would you not teach if you had a big enough project? You know, it would be hard to give up teaching, I think.
Do you consider it to be part of the same mix of research that you kind of described each project being? So, you know, if as you described, one of the things that you like about an architectural project is that you get to make it a research project, each project is its own new world, and you research and look at things in a new way. Does teaching kind of feed into that, either generally or specifically to projects that you do?
You know, I've unfortunately always taught core. So I teach first year or second year MArch, right? And because it's part of the core, the studios are very basic and set, and there's a lot of stuff that you just need to communicate that maybe isn't about experimentation, etc. But I do think what teaching gives you is this totally open environment. Like, in the end, like, those projects don't have to meet certain constraints that we have to all meet, right? And because of that, they're able to, I think, first of all, they get a whole semester to study a project. I mean, that's just an amazing luxury of time, you know? Especially when you're trying to design a project in a weekend or something like that. And I also think that they become an interesting... Maybe this shouldn't be published, but you can test a certain idea, like, can scripting really have a productive role in the design process? And you can use your studio of 12 people and a TA to see if that, you know, and it can fail, and it's okay, because you're going to be able to learn something from it and fine-tune it, etc., or know that it should be dumped and, you know, maybe it wasn't the right idea. Whereas the constraints of practice are you have to hit it, and you have to succeed every time, and that's what we're finding exhausting.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's not a dirty secret. That faculty use the studio's testing ground for ideas. It's the idea of academia or of a kind of lab-based research.
Yeah, well, and the students like it. You know, they know that that's the deal, and they like being involved in research in an experiment that the result isn't already known.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think even though I think we've both been teaching pretty much core, I think there are ways to turn a first-year studio into a bit of research, depending on what you choose to study. I mean, it's not the place to study flexible photovoltaics, but it might be the place to study aggregation, or it might be the place to study certain geometrical techniques. Just to make that part of your research.
Go backwards, go the other way.
Yeah. I think Scott has been able to use first years as a way to do his own research. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. Yeah. It's probably fed his practice as much as he's...
Yeah, by foregrounding the whole geometrical question.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
You guys are probably... Should I wait for me to come? You guys are considered to be like very cutting edge in many ways, you know, use scripting for the Guggenheim or interactive stuff or whatnot. So can you guys tell a little bit more about how the digital processes work, maybe specifically or in general?
I don't think we'd make that claim. I don't think we'd claim to be cutting edge anything. I think I think some of the integration of technologies was early, but I would say it's still primitive. I wouldn't say it's cutting edge or sophisticated. And using digital tools is not, I think, our primary...
But even if... I mean, we do use, of course, digital tools, but we just don't think it's cutting edge. We just think it's what we should all be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think our definition of innovation might need to be a little bit qualified, because we think innovation can happen at a very small scale. It doesn't need to revolutionize the world. It just needs to have an impact at some scale, and that can be very small.
But I think, like, when we did PS1, that was an eye-opener for us, because we didn't know how to go about it. And when we started, we were sort of folding paper, and then we discovered that we needed to use a three-dimensional Voronoi script, and then we realized that we needed to
have that script written from scratch, because we couldn't use the one that was...
Yeah, so I think that was more a question of like developing a tool for a particular use, mm-hmm. than it was like we really want to use this kind of digital tool. It sort of came together without planning, and so it was so much more interesting because it was really eye opening. It's like, wow, you know, we could use this computational tool to achieve this objective. So I think that was one of our first encounters with those techniques. But I don't think I wouldn't say it's cutting edge, and I wouldn't say it's part of an agenda. I think it's by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. Really, it's like, what do you need to do to get something done in a way that will allow you to do it?
But the digital allows you to imagine things that you could do that you wouldn't.
Yeah,
otherwise.
That's true. Like, it is a kind of chicken egg thing.
A digital imagination.
No, I think it's similar to the electronics. It's because you've seen in the world some aspects of things that are possible, then it allows you to imagine modifications to those things, or transformations, or ideas that may be somewhat parallel, but clearly you see that there is a possibility for that. And then you can research how to do it. So you can't imagine the project without sort of knowing that something like that might be possible.
But it's interesting, speaking about agenda, so if you know, as you've said, maybe you don't have a digital agenda, but you use digital tools. On the complete opposite end of the spectrum, but maybe still related to agenda, do you have any agenda in relation to the role and responsibility of the architect, say, in given the current state of the world, or basically given any state of any world? Like, or would you similarly say, well, it depends on the project, different projects have different aims, but so do you kind of see what I'm getting at? Like, is there some agenda, not process-based, because mm-hmm. you've kind of talked about that already, but more like the role of the architect and responsibilities to society or environment? Or
I think there's multiple agendas, so maybe we can talk about a couple of them. I think there's our generation feels that there's pressure to be intelligent about the architecture. So whether that means the architecture has some intelligence or the strategy of the architectural investigation is intelligent, and we can have different definitions of what that means. But I think that's one agenda. I think the second agenda is that it's it takes what's familiar and defamiliarizes it just enough that it makes people question certain givens. Mm-hmm. I think that's an agenda to the work. It's maybe more subtle, but it's something I'm conscious of.
I think there's a desire to produce some innovation that's going to push something forward, whether it's...
That's what I just said.
No, there's defamiliarization and innovation are different.
Okay.
I think, then they're both, I think, interesting. You know, I think we would never want to do the same thing twice, because that just wouldn't be interesting. So there is a sort of hunger, not for novelty, but for difference or for the innovative. And I think this idea of wanting to learn something at each phase, you know, wanting to sort of, you know, like we did this green wall thing, which, you know, we're not so sure how it turned out, but it was something that we didn't know anything about, we wanted to do, and so we sort of set out to do it. I think that's a good attitude to have, to identify things that you don't know anything about, mm-hmm. that you want to learn something about and test. So
I also think, like, you know, we've been doing a lot of projects that maybe deal with the issue of sustainability, but I would say sustainability is not our agenda. I would say that in the given state, like, every architect should just take it as a given, mm-hmm. you know? So it's not our agenda.
Like digital tools.
Yeah.
Like digital tools. But there's ways that you can work with it in such a way that it creates heightened awareness mm-hmm. of the phenomena. And so that might be an agenda as well.
I mean, I'm reminded about a sort of discussion between Scott and Farshid at the GSD, where Scott says, you must bring your agenda to every project, regardless of the project. And Farshid said, how could you possibly know until you get to the project what the agenda is going to be? So I think they represent two different takes. One is like more, I would say one is more agile and provisional. It's like, let's tackle the problem, see what the parameters are, mm-hmm. figure out what's appropriate, and then sort of come up with a strategy of response to that condition. The other approach is to say, I've got my agenda, and I'm going to get, no matter what it is, at what scale it is,
this is what I bring.
You know, you hire me because I bring this agenda. You know, and that's a continuity to the project, because across all scales and in all sites and in all geographic contexts, the agenda is the same. I think we probably fit in the latter one, the provisional one, the kind of agile one. Let's wait and see what the issues are. So I think there is no sort of continuity of form or technique or process. It's always based on the situation.
It's more about how incredibly inefficient it is as a model, though, right? I mean, you keep insisting on the kind of that nothing is transferable, nothing. Each project has a kind of contingency. The importance of approaching. To say the obvious, it's such a different project than what we all, the kind of, the legacy of the modernist project where you want to have some kind of idea of not even prototypical nature, but something that's transferable that you can kind of build upon an idea, right? Instead, there's this, I mean, it's purely agile.
Yeah, but it's, I like the pure agility mm-hmm. of it. I like the idea of it. And I don't want to romanticize inefficiency because, mm-hmm. you know, we are inefficient and we sort of invent a problem at every turn, and we mm-hmm. sort of, but I think there are things that are transferred, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, an idea of a kind of sensor technology from one project might sort of fold into another one, it might fold into another one, so there are kind of these kind of, one project serves as a prototype for the next. Mm-hmm.
And also, like, the limit, like, white noise, white light wasn't networked, and there were some benefits of that, but then you realize, oh, there could have been some benefits to having them networked. And then also, like, dealing with touch. And so, like, the next opportunity, we're like, okay, let's take that a little further. Let's network in this time and use capacity sensing. We don't know enough about capacity sensing, but we'll figure it out, you know, this kind of thing. So there is transfer. It's not 100% inefficient.
It also seems like what Mijin was talking about before, rather than agenda, there's, like, a higher, almost like a purpose to why you would be even in architecture, because you, I guess it's not an agenda, but it's something that you value even more, that's kind of a more like a purpose. I don't know if I'm coming across or something. Like, for example, you know, you mentioned, you know, you want to create this kind of, like, defamiliarize kind of a familiar condition because you see certain imaginative or certain value in it. I think that could even be very consistent throughout all projects, even though every project has a different agenda. So in that sense, maybe when you're describing that conversation you had at the school, maybe they're using the same word agenda, but it seems like maybe they're thinking of agenda in a different hierarchy, even, you know, one more the hierarchy of kind of something, a larger purpose maybe, and something that's a little bit more like really a specific agenda for the project.
I think you could have a kind of overarching agenda and have a situational technique or kind of site-specific, situation-specific response, you know, so you're not doing the same thing every time, but you are building a certain kind of expertise, or you are building a certain body of research.
But then along those lines, and maybe, you know, I know we should be wrapping up, but to imagine the... I mean, I'm interested in the idea of agility and reinventing every time, and you know, both techniques, innovation, defamiliarization. And then I'm thinking to your future. I mean, and building a body of work. Do you imagine continuing to do this kind of thing at this kind of scale with this size of office for a career, you know, and give us and the field and your peers, you know, that much more of the body of work of you know, new versions of looking at individual things? Or do you have a kind of another progression in mind? Or just even more specifically, do you imagine the size of the office is going to be the same for the next 20 years?
I mean, I think we always hope that there is a convergence, because I feel like we've been doing kind of parallel research streams all along, and some might be more about this technique, and some might be more about this technology, and some might be about this kind of formal research, etc. And we anticipate, hopefully, in the next couple of years that a convergence will be possible, that it is not as inefficient as it currently is. Only so that we can start, because we're so exhausted all the time, only so we can begin to start producing these at a scale that it has more impact, because I think we're doing a lot of design build, because otherwise it wouldn't be able to happen. And it would be nice to do a little bit less design build, have other entities take over some of the fabrication part of the projects, so that we could be designing more than figuring things out technically, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, again, we never sort of mapped this out. It's sort of, it's sort of happening as it goes. We're sort of making it up as we go. I mean, I think, you know, we would love to take on bigger projects. Who wouldn't? But I think we wouldn't want to lose touch of the kind of, the kind of fun sort of exploratory ones.
You know? I don't think this off practice could exist if it were more than, let's say, 15, 20 people tops.
Well, I mean, I was at Dealer's Video when Lincoln Center happened, and the office tripled in size in the 3 years.
So it went from 6 to 18?
From 12 to around 45, you know, the time I was there. And I think there was a feeling that, isn't it great we can do Lincoln Center and test things at a much larger scale, and, you know, in a very public place in New York, and you know, what a great client, because they're center of culture. There's all kinds of content being generated, performing arts, spectacle, theater. I mean, all this stuff, brilliant, perfect. On the other hand, there was a sense that we're so busy doing architecture that there weren't the kind of small scale, you know, interventions that that everyone sort of knew and loved about Dealer's Good Video. And so I was constantly lamenting the fact that the kind of the fun, money-losing projects weren't happening at the same rate as the kind of, you know, fun, money-making projects. Like, the architecture projects were so all-absorbing that they weren't finding the time to do the kind of fun, you know, performance pieces or the fun sort of set design pieces that they loved doing. So, you know, hopefully we'll have an opportunity to do something larger, but hopefully we won't be in a position where we're no longer doing the fun.
We like to think that we would, even if we have a $4 million project in the office, we would still be willing to do a $4,000 project.
Mm-hmm.
And so far that's been true. Like, we have a pretty crazy range of 100 times the budget from small to large.
Wow, that's a good metric for a firm. Maybe that should be what we all cover. But then again, how would you factor in zero? Like, because all projects have zero, so that's like infinity times.
By infinity.
Well, that's probably a good way to end, but do you have any question that you wish we had asked you that we can, you can whisper it to us, and then we can...
Thank you
so much for coming up, and we'll figure out about next week.
Okay.
Just quickly, so you can do Friday, potentially.
Yeah, I think you suggested Friday morning. Okay. That sounds good. Friday morning is better, actually.
Okay, zero can't do morning, is that right? But you might do, can you do lunchtime on Friday or no?
Yeah, probably. We both probably have to be at school at 2.
Okay, that's good to know. And then what about on Thursday, you could still do, could you do, move into lunchtime when you should then instead of the 11 o'clock slot? Or the same issue on Thursday?
Sue has to be somewhere early afternoon.
Yeah, I have to be at school by 1.
Okay, we'll figure it out. Thank you guys, it was really interesting.
Bye.
We all, after interview, we always say, like, we should just have these conversations more often, right? Like,
yeah.
Bye.
Great. On your blog, the Praxis blog. Well.
Is there a Praxis blog?
No. But they could continually feed information to you.
Are we done?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye.
Ashley, is there any other way we should wrap this up? I don't know if there's a question.
Concluding remarks.
you think we missed in the conversation?
Can I see? I didn't bring my list of questions.
You want to ask these guys a question?
No, I mean, I think these conversations are so interesting because, you know, what issues come up and what people are comfortable talking about. And I think the potential for this issue is to take a kind of snapshot of a particular moment. Mm-hmm. It's not like this is going to be, you know, true forever. You know, this is, you know, 6 months after the, you know, the economic meltdown. This is maybe, you know, 3 years before the next boom. You know, so, you know, to take a kind of snapshot of a particular mindset of a particular group of people is kind of interesting. You know, we haven't talked about, you know, the economy that much, but I hear... Whenever you talk to architects, they're always sort of speculating about, you know, what should we be doing more of? You know, what kind of work is possible now? Yesterday I was on this jury and somebody, you know, people were talking about beauty, they were talking about details, they were talking about effects, they were talking about, but someone's like, God damn it, you know, we gotta talk about, you know, what architecture is if it's not excess, you know, like, and what are we gonna produce? How are we gonna do more with less? There's a kind of an imperative to, you know, to get through this crisis somehow, and I think it's interesting people take a strong position about, you know, what we should be promoting through an award, for example, or what discourses we should be sort of supporting, you know, through our conversation, mm-hmm. through our discussion. You know, what do we choose collectively to talk about at this particular moment? You know, besides the kind of doom and gloom, like, oh, who let go of so and so, and what, you know. What are the ways that we can be instrumental in this particular time? And I think it'd be good if this issue had some hints about, you know, how
well,
we move forward.
One of the questions is like, and that kind of didn't get asked so much, mm-hmm. is like, do you see a way out? And could there be? I mean, I have heard, yeah, there's a lot of gloom and doom, but I have heard a couple of architects actually express. Their opinion at a certain
optimism.
Good
time. Yeah.
That it could
I
be
agree.
Actually a really great time.
I agree. I 100% so, agree. I mean, I feel like in the last, you know, 2 years, like, we just can't keep up. The demands and the speed at which, and the projects, the number of projects is kind of exponential, and you find yourself, you're not able to deliver a kind of project that you would like to deliver because you're trying to do it too fast. And things slowing down, I think, will be good because it'll allow us to think more and it will allow the work to get better. I really believe that. But, you know, I also think that it will allow, hopefully, our generation to take on the kind of pressing issues of our time, which are clearly energy sustainability, and I think that we're ready to do it because in the last couple of years, we've kind of gotten our feet wet. We've all built a couple of small things. We're setting ourselves up, and I think we're now ready to take on harder questions and more difficult problems. Until now, it's been like kids in a candy store. We've been experimenting. We've been like, you know, playing with all these new digital tools, playing with all these new technologies. And now I think, I mean, it's good that that moment existed, because now in this period, I think we will be ready to do something more relevant and more potent than had this arrived before the candy store moment.
And you think that's because you have clients who want that?
I think we also know that we can operate without clients that want that, that we can smuggle in our agendas to projects because we have, you know, at a different scale in the past.
No, I agree. I think waiting for a client to call is that's probably not the mode of the next 5 years. I think for people to find ways to produce work without clients, you know, more.
And that's going to be through.
That's culturally relevant.
Yeah.
And that's going to be through.
Through grants, you know, through writing, through independent research, through partnerships with academic institutions. And those are all the things that you guys and our peers have been nurturing over the last, you know, several
years.
Maybe it's
time to think about that entrepreneurial thing again.
In a different way, yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think for all of us that, you know, the idea of you know, self-funding is kind of terrifying. But, you know, finding a support, you know, from industry or from academia is something, or cultural institutions, something we kind of rely on. But I think this idea of waiting for a client, the kind of passivity of that, I think is over. You know, I think finding places
making
to do
clients,
unsolicited work, and finding opportunities for that, I think it's going to force designers into a different mode, into a more active mode.
Yeah, well, along the lines that if one thing we do as architects is respond to problems, which could be a client's problem, like how do I build my house, you know, in a certain site, then thinking of it more broadly, our time, our current moment with a lot of problems is, that's already our client, you know.
Yeah,
problems are there.
Absolutely.
And so one model for this, I don't know how much I buy into it, but it's like the Al Gore, like, green entrepreneur, like, venture capital fund. Like, all of these environmental problems create huge burdens, but also, in a way, in a kind of strange way, as architects, as problem solvers, that's like a gold mine. You know, there's a huge problem with a bunch of sub-problems, and we can just go, you know, research them and think about them.
And I also think, like, in our generation, like, one of the early questions that you ask is, has to do with our peers, but I actually think, like, the mindset of our peers has also changed, as we have in the last, you know, 2 years. And I think that mindset is more somber, more responsible, and more committed to trying to be less self-absorbed about minutiae of architectural, you know,
issues.
Like innovation for innovation's sake, or playing for just the sake of playing. I think we've done that, and I can see it. I can see the shift in a lot of architects right now towards, okay, now that we've done that, what can we do that engages these problems?
There's a desire for relevance, you know, that somehow some of that stuff is somehow irrelevant or superfluous or excessive. Or
I mean, you see it in the way, like, PS1 has shifted, too, in terms of their selection process as well.
I'm not sure that that's an accurate barometer of any sort of cultural situation.
But has the, do you think this year's is more relevant?
Oh, I didn't see. Like, oh, Michael. Yeah. I don't understand Michael, but
this is off the record.
Yeah, I mean, I think they pitch their thing as just, like, super low cost and super, like, so I don't.
Yeah, and there's, like, things are getting recycled somehow.
Yeah. Actually, Para, do you guys remember Para's submission? Theirs was a little bit more, I guess, responsible in a way. The 2x4 is stacked up, but then you can recycle the 2x4 for other projects.
Yeah, okay, there is a shift that's being measured through PS1. But
no, I don't know that there is. I don't think Michael's really... I mean, last year's for sure seemed to be wanting
a
to
definitive,
just,
you know, break
from the kind of formal excesses.
And with excesses.
Sorry.
No. Well, thanks for the question.
Yeah, thank you.
I really appreciated the way you answered the questions, which were not at all, they were with thoughtful answers. They weren't. It seemed to me.
Because we don't have any ready-made answers.
Yeah. And I like that. And I like that. You know, just the kind of. Honesty and thoughtfulness of which you answered.
Also
it felt good.
Kind of sincerity towards the role of the architect and what we can actually do in society and to people, I think it was really nice to hear your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think if we had the tape recorder off, we'd have a different conversation. Not too different. But, you know, I think that the tape recorder implies a kind of seriousness, you know, so we have to be somewhat serious. But the conversations we have without tape recorders or just, you know, texting with each other, like, you know.
Eric and Michael text, like, so much. It drives me crazy. But we don't Twitter.
It's not something that you would ever publish, and it's not even interesting to read, but the kind of day-to-day kind of informal communication, it's maybe more kind of goal-oriented. It's like, can you send me something? What do you think of that? You know, it wouldn't be interesting to read, but you know, the kind of things we talk about amongst ourselves.
It's really banal.
No, I mean it's.
It is. It's like, can you send me a contract? How do you spec this?
Things we want to know from each other are not necessarily the kind of things practice wants to publish, but they are the day-to-day things that we're, you know, the transfer of information that's happening, you know.
Well, that's one of the most interesting things.
This conversation's a little bit more elevated than that.
Otherwise, we'd be saying, like, well, where did you get that microcontroller? Like, what, you know,
yeah.
What did you use to fabricate that? You know, there's another kind of information transfer that happens that isn't interesting to read, but is another flow, another channel.
Well, that's the extension of the shorter and shorter. Like, it goes from books to magazines to blogs to text messages. And that's why Twitter is just interesting. Like, I don't use Twitter very much either, but it has that, like, limit of characters. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, mandated, like, super short.
It just means we're all able to, you know, think in less.
But then it's like, yeah, maybe any single message in that, like, type of communication doesn't mean that much, but there must be some way to aggregate and sort that does mean more. Mm-hmm. You know, just search engine style of, like, most popular words is probably totally relevant. Like, if we could get a record of all of your text messages, forward them all to us, and then, like, sort them by, you know, something, it's probably, like, totally relevant to the state of our field and generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I hope you guys have those people, too. I assume that even though we're just a little bit off, that...
Well, you know what's really interesting is that I totally relate in terms of approach. I think we are constantly emailing our friends and, you know, peers and saying, you know, we need some kind of contract or some kind of subcontractor or whatever. But a lot of ours at this point are still working for other people.
Yeah.
So not as many of the people we graduated from school with are but they're actually good resources for contracts and other things.
Because they have stuff from
other firms.
And I guess I am more aware of it.
And they're contractors.
I think when I was at Dolores Cafillo, I wasn't supposed to, but I was doing a lot of work with Mugen.
Turn this on.
And I think it's very interesting, the sub-firms.